Welcome again to the third panel session of Ontology Summit 2010. The day today is the 4th of February 2010, and our talk is Training Requirements for Ontologists. We are very fortunate to have gotten an excellent panel to join us for this, including Drew Sedford, Mike Eschold, Mike Bennett, and Tom Silla, and we will get to them just a few refresher comments and also an announcement. Could you go to the abstract, Peter?
Yes.
Okay. To summarize, just to remind us what we're doing, this year's summit is on the creation of the ontologies of the future that is responding to the growing need for trained ontologists by developing public curricula and content for training good ontologists, understanding that in order to do that effectively, we need a little better understanding of who is the profession and what we do to make sure that training matches the actual need. And this would be my third slide, the opening comments one. Sorry. As the organizing committee worked on how this year's summit would unfold, three facts were identified: one on the actual content of training, one on quality, which incorporates both how training can be delivered in a quality manner and how it can be delivered to produce quality results. And the third track is the requirements track, understanding what it is that the ontologists who come out of this training are going to have to do, what the training needs to prepare them for. And as those of you are here, this is our focal panel, as part of the ongoing discussion of this. So, this, as I said, grows out of the understanding that we better understand ourselves as a profession, and that brings us to the next slide and our announcement. This is slide 4 now. We are launching additional surveys today. We have at previous sessions talked about the surveys, and one of them was initially launched, but there was, I think, some confusion about where it fit in the overall picture. So it's sort of getting a relaunch today, along with the other two. So the three surveys that we have now available, and Peter, I think, has just sent out an invitation pointing people towards these. The first survey, the one that had been initially released and was sort of relaunching more in context, focuses on the kind of training that goes on now. What exists now? What do people cover and how do they do it? The second survey corresponds to the topic of this panel today, and in my opinion is going to be critical to our getting the volume and quality of complex and quality of information that we really want to better this understanding. And that is, that second survey is one that is targeted at anyone who is an ontologist, may sometimes be an ontologist, is thinking of becoming an ontologist, hires ontologists, trains ontologists, evaluates ontologists, needs them and doesn't know where to find them, and so forth. And it's very much looking at the same kinds of questions that we will be talking about today. The third study is a study of the future, I'll let Peter and Elizabeth say more about this in a second. To solicit community views of what, where are ontologists be doing? in the future. I want to emphasize that it's very important contribution to the future of ontologist training for each of the summit and community participants to respond to these and to circulate information about them to anyone else you think could contribute important information and will be interested in doing so. So if any of the survey champions want to sign in here?
Peter Yim here. Maybe I'll just say a little about how we're doing the futures study on ontologists, their education in the field of ontology. We have partnered up with the Millennium Project people, who are actually one of the best-known group of futurists that used to be with the United Nations University. And since our theme for this year's summit is creating the ontologist of the future, so to properly craft a set of education and training material and set up the corresponding quality expectations, we better have some idea as to what the future is going to be like. Are we training 1 million people? Are we training 1,000 people? I mean, these are real questions that people who need to craft the material have in their inventory. So we are using a sort of real-time Delphi tool to help us elicit input from ontology domain experts. Real-time Delphi tools are an extension of the original Delphi technique developed by Rand in the late 50s. A nominal Delphi study takes months to complete, maybe 6 months. But Ted Gordon and his colleagues have put it online onto the web to allow us to reduce this cycle from months to maybe days or just a few weeks. So, and back in December, we already had a session and collected community input that tells us what the major development might be. And with those developments, we created the platform so that people could walk in and chime in against the various developments, provide their opinion, tell us when these things might likely happen, what it takes to get there, what are the barriers from stopping us from getting there, and so on. And collectively, no one can predict the future, but collectively, our community of experts may be able to map out a vision as to what the field is going to be like in the future. So that's all I have to say. Elizabeth, you have anything to add? No? Then back to Amanda.
Okay, thank you. Arturo, I think, is with us. Arturo, do you want to add anything on the first survey?
I think that, I mean, our survey is probably the most straightforward one. It just aims at finding out what people are doing right now in terms of ontologies. That's pretty much it. And also, if people have any awareness of any official ways of certifying ontologies as professionals. So those are pretty much the two of them. Thank you for the opportunity to explain.
Sure. Okay, and I think I already said something about the second one, which is the one that I'm championing, and I will remind folks of it and say a little more at the very end today. So without further ado, let's move on to our panel. Go to the next slide, Peter?
Yes.
Thank you. Each of our panelists today embodies one or more most cases more end user perspective, either somebody who's learned by doing what it takes to do ontology in situ, supervised, hired, developed others to do so, probably experienced. I know at least some of us are in areas where there are work with other folks who learn by trial and error how to develop ontologists, and we get the joys of discovering what works and what doesn't that way. So I've asked each of them I'm not going to go through details, introduction of each. Their bios are online on the OntologWiki. Let me just say, Dr. Bedford is a bigger professor of knowledge management at Penn State. Probably most folks here know her more from her previous position with the World Bank, where she's been part of our community for a long time as the OntologWiki. Mike, I think your bio might be not updated. With respect to Falling Phantom Works, I think that you can update that when you're going to talk if you want to. Mike Bennett is the Director of Semantics and Standards at the Enterprise Data Management Council. Services industry and has lots of real life applied ontology experience from that angle. And John Sella, who's been working on various projects at IBM and VivoMind, applying ontology in many different ways, in many different contexts. So, if you go to the next slide, I have roughly asked the panel to think about questions like these and present some minutes of remarks from their own perspective, feeling free to emphasize and de-emphasize aspects of those views as they deem appropriate rather than trying to exhaustively cover things. So, without further ado, I would like to turn things to our first panelist, Denise Bedford.
Okay. Well, thank you all for inviting me to participate with this panel today. Let me just say that I put this presentation together in a bit of a hurried fashion, so it's got a few faults, many faults. Let me tell you where I'm coming from. I'm most recently coming from an enterprise architecture perspective and group. Let's see, I'm on slide 2 of 1. So my background is really looking at information architecture, data architecture, and something new that we're calling knowledge architecture. So I've been trained over the past 10 years, essentially, and by one enterprise architect in particular, Hindapada, who look at things from an as is in a 2D state. So what I've done in this presentation is to look at where I think we are with ontology work today and then where I think we need to be in the future. So please keep in mind that I'm taking more of a macro view of this than I think a micro view. So I will leave it to others to speak to the specific ontology construction tools and methods, but I'm going to talk about, say, the broader skill set that I think we need. It's what I really see is missing. Okay, slide 3, please. So this ontology today, obviously, study of being, existence, and reality. I'm going to emphasize the purpose of this is to help machines understand what people know. the problem is this, you know, in this discussion a lot, people don't agree on what they know, and people know different from the same entity. So our work in ontology development doesn't start with encoding or characterization from my perspective. It starts long before that. So another challenge we have today is, I think, and you will find that this is my personal perspective, but it comes from many years of dealing with challenges. I think that I know that the classification idea is generic to ontology development, but I don't think that's the only approach we need to take in terms of characterizing entities. Okay, I think that there are other important ways we need to think about how we characterize entities. Classification is one, but it's not the only way you need to apply logic. So I think the other challenge we have today is that we're focused largely on transforming existing reference structures to ontological form, rather than stepping back and looking at and developing it in a new context. Some of the work of the groups that formed as a result of the last ontology summit, I think, are taking a new approach. I'm thinking in particular of the work that Frank Olkin and his group are doing. Okay, I'm on slide four. I think in the future we need to focus on what I would call ontological descriptions versus ontological classifications. So here I would say that the characteristics of entities are not necessarily limited to simply classifying the entities to one or more classes, etc. There are multiple characterizations of an entity that are not only possible but important. So I would say that in the future we need to have ontologists who can work in an environment where we're not developing it's more middle-out or bottom-up approach, looking very much at a problem in a specific context. And I would say in a business context, business with a small b, looking at it from a practice perspective. So looking at those entities that are important to describe ontologically, and then trying to see how all of the various aspects of that entity can be synthesized, harmonized, where they can be, where they can't be, etc. I hope that makes sense. Slide five. So in terms of competencies for ontologists, my sense today, and I'm just coming from a particular perspective, is that the primary focus is on coding and backroom operations, largely involving technical skills for people who are engaged in ontological engineering. But in the future, I think ontologists' role needs to expand. They need to be a bridge between the practical context in which the entity has value and then the technical context in which it's going to be implemented. So I think the skills and competencies need to expand to include more subject matter experts, knowledge, elicitation, representation, entity modeling, and description. I think on slide six, so another question that Amanda asked us to think about, I think, is what kinds of knowledge organizations that can work is within or heading toward formal ontology development. I think this helps us to understand some of the other skills that might be important. Or the domains that that ontologists need to be able to communicate and work with. These would include, at least from my experience, master data management. I think there's huge opportunity for ontology applications in business rule development, although these seem to be two entirely unconnected domains right now. Business semantics and business object development, and then semantic analysis, profiling of entity attributes. So what types of projects do ontologists work on? Well, I I would say that ontology-like or ontology-like work is being done anywhere you have entities being defined or coded, anywhere you've got any kind of logic that's being applied to those entities. It may not be a formal ontology representation, but it's a kind of ontology development work that's being done. And this, I think, is a great opportunity for ontologists in the future. So an ontological workflow doesn't look too different from a regular software development lifecycle or from a product development lifecycle. My perception, and again, I could be coming out of a very isolated environment, is that we largely focus on the bottom half of the second step, the entity and ontological design, and then the testing step. So we really need to have ontologists develop further skills within the first area with the requirements and the problem characterization. So for whom do ontologists work? Well, data services, data quality areas, units, application support, particularly any kind of operational or business process management, business rule development. We've had ontologists working in enterprise architecture groups, and again, that master data management. I would say you have ontologists working for every sector in the economy. Probably you have more obvious ontological work being done in, say, military, biology, etc. But I just think if you looked at all sectors, you'd find some form of this work going on. So what competencies do ontologists need to know and need to have? I really think they need to understand the business context. So you've got to start with domain knowledge, with knowledge of processes, process behaviors, how people in those domains make decisions and how they think about entities. This is the hard part. This is what we have all the arguments about, but the arguments are not disruptive, they're constructive. And so I think this, being able to build a big picture around the disagreements is really the essence of developing ontology. Knowledge elicitation. They also, I think, need to know the existing knowledge organization systems. They need to know the warrants for those systems, the gaps, deficiencies, common data structures, etc. I think modeling is really important. I think they need to also understand the basic encoding structures, logic, inference structures, etc. This is where I think we probably have the greatest knowledge now. We need to understand also risk management and tolerance. What's an acceptable fault rate and what is an unacceptable fault rate in a particular domain? Because how well we engineer that ontology should align with how a person is going to be making a decision or what a person would understand in that particular domain. And, of course, I think we need to also understand basic application development testing methods. What do ontologists need to know in terms of skills? Sorry, I'm on page, I'm on slide 10. Some of the soft sides. Communication and listening skills. A lot of patience, because working through design is a very iterative process, and in this case, it's also at a very primitive understanding level. So patience is really critical here. Attitude. I think ontologists need to be able to leave their ego at home, because their role is really facilitation, not decision. So they need to listen and understand how a person who's working in that domain perceives that entity. They need to have sort of a balanced left and right brain. Definitely a service orientation in their attitudes, know when the design and the product are good enough to move forward. You cannot have perfectionists. Well, I shouldn't say that. in some areas where perfection is critical, I suppose that's appropriate, but it's not going to be critical in all domains. And they need to be able to work with other people. They need to be able to collaborate. Just being able to understand different perspectives. Slide 11, so where do ontologists learn? Since I think, so where do they get the training? I think this is going to be one of the major shifts. I would characterize where this should happen as sort of an interdisciplinary context, more along the lines of knowledge architects and knowledge engineering, where domain experts can learn the architecture and the engineering side, where architects and engineers can learn the business side, and sort of where they can also learn how to manage maintain ontology, not just one-time development and storage. So if this is to become a formal discipline, I think there needs to be some academic credentials supporting it. So, and I think this is going to come out of new departments and new, based on new curricula. We have been looking at some of these courses that could be offered in essentially a knowledge engineering track at Kent State. I think employers are probably more often they're not expecting modeling capabilities, not necessarily encoding capabilities, because not all the employers out there are going to have a good understanding of ontological engineering. Let's see. So how are ontologists selected? I think by and large they're probably selected today based on their modeling skills and coding skills. It's unfortunately why I think most of the work is not necessarily progressed in a sustainable way, because we're not really anchoring it in that business context. So what is sustainable is the essential characterization and description, and I would say we need to focus more on the process. And obviously you can tell I'm at home with a chow chow in the background, so I finished just in time before he started barking. So I'm going to sign off now. Thank you all very much.
All right. Thank you, Denise. That was fantastic. I think we will, unless there are terribly urgent questions that need to be answered right now, I think we'll go on and go on to our next panel and sort of group the discussion at the end. So our next panel is up. This is Mike Ushold.
Yes, Amanda?
Yes.
Can you maybe take one or two questions? I just noticed Mike sent in an updated, there's some updated material. So give me a couple of minutes to post that.
Sure. Okay, Ravi. I see Ravi turned up. Go ahead, Ravi. Call 3. Ravi, are you there?
Amanda, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can. Amanda, this is Denise. I think I can see Ravi's question in the chat room.
Yeah,
okay,
Ravi.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ravi.
No, would you like to respond to that?
Yes, I think I agree with you. So an example of the business would be a domain area such as SDRL for financial services. Yes, I would agree with that.
And then further, I looked at your slides and I see that you do put a lot of emphasis on MDM, and that's very good because it at least gives you enterprise-level data dictionary.
Would you... Ravi, if I can interrupt, would you unpack it a little bit for other folks on in the session who may not know exactly what you're referring to?
Okay, master data management is an effort by people to do enterprise level rationalization and harmonization of data and data related terms being used in the enterprise. My question to Dennis was more in taking data level entities into information level entities of interest to business, because the mechanisms such as vocabulary and terms that transcribe data to information and allow it to be shared or exchanged among contracting parties, that is really where ontology can play a lot more semantic meaning into play. I would like your comments.
I think my response would be I totally agree. I think this is the major area of opportunity. My challenge has been, though, over the past 2 years at the World Bank, though, was that the architecture world, in the traditionally trained enterprise architects, don't see any value for ontology work. This was a major challenge to even, you know, get the idea of semantic analysis or ontologies in the conversation. But I think this is a major area of opportunity.
Yes, I fully agree. Just 2 cents worth in there. They will start confronting need for semantics and ontology as they go more cross-exercises, as they go more federated, and as they go more in terms of diverse sources of information from which they have to extract semantic meaning, either for events or for data collection, or what they call in these days linked data, etc.
I totally agree. We had this challenge even crossing between the IBRD and IFC, two major parts of a single organization. Yeah. And they would not look at ontology. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. I will return to Peter now. I think he's ready.
Yes.
I'll mute myself.
Okay. Thank you, Robbie, and thank you, Denise. And you can continue that after if appropriate. Now we will go on to our second panelist, Mike Ushel, whose slides are now being brought up by Peter. Mike, you have the floor.
Oh. Hello, can you hear me well?
You can.
Excellent. Okay, so I'm going to, I just posted a couple of slides. I think that they're up there now. And I'm going to talk about, kind of focus not on all the different questions, but focusing on the things that ontologists need to do and some of the things that ontologists need to know that derive from that. So really the focus is on doing and then bringing in a little bit of the knowledge that's required. So one thing is about customers and stakeholders. It's really important in my many years at Boeing, you know, talking to people to get them interested. So a skill set that is going to be required by ontologists in the future is the ability to interview customers and stakeholders. And the key thing there, there's really two things. One is, does it even make sense to have an ontology-based solution in the first place? That involves, you know, good skills, asking good questions, understanding the customer's problem, and knowing that there's other technologies out there that you know, might suit the problem better, and understanding exactly those circumstances when the ontology-based solution with, you know, the other semantic technology infrastructure comes along with it is really going to be the right solution. That's a really important skill to have. Second, kind of going down the next level of detail, competency questions. So basically, competency questions are ontology requirements. So all that is going to be required is to be able to, again, work with customers, stakeholders, but exactly what their ontology, you know, what they need to deliver, and then work with that to back and say, well, in order to deliver that to my customer, I'm going to formulate my ontology so that it performs the necessary things to add the value the customer is after. So that's a matter of taking the ontology requirements from the customer, formulating those as specific competency questions, a la Michael Gunninger and Mark Fox from many years ago. And by the way, this is not just something that's for academic interest. Competency questions played a major role in the development of the good relations ontology, which is having a big splash in commerce and industry. It might actually be the killer app for the semantic web. So competency questions are very important. You start with informal competency questions, with kind of general concepts, and then add a more formal vocabulary, develop more formal competency questions that are really in the final language using the terms of actual ontology. And really, the competency questions and the ontology requirements should be driving the whole ontology engineering process. And this is something that ontologists will need to know. Next, ontologists are going to need to be very familiar with a wide range of languages and tools. So I'm not going to list them all, but just the obvious ones, OWL, RDF, Richter Logic, Common Logic, F-Logic, and there's any number of other formulations out there, topic maps. So the ontologist is really going to need to know, because you might go into a company and they only use topic maps. They have Ontopia's suite of tools, and guess what? That's what you need to work with. So you need to have a wide range of knowledge of the different things that are out there. Similarly, inference engines. What inference engines are good at? What languages do they work with? What tools do they come with? Semantic computing infrastructure. There's also a lot of that out there. It's changing fast. There's some open source. There's some that's company specific. Some companies have their own individual platforms, et cetera, et cetera. That's an important area that people need to be quite familiar with. There is two slides I borrowed from an excellent compendium of ontology tools. If you go to www.mkbergman.com and then just do it under the word compendium, you'll come up with this. It was put out relatively recently. There's probably like 100 or so different tools categorized according to the nature of the tool, whether it's in common use or not. Is it open source or whatnot? Very valuable. So we need to have broad familiarity with what's out there. That's what you need to know. But what do you need to be able to do? And that is to, given a certain customer's need and requirements to get a value that they want, you need to be able to identify these candidate languages and tools that can meet a customer's requirements. Okay? And so you need to know what the key criteria are going to inform such a choice. And this is, again, going to come from the customer and what they specifically need. Do they need high performance? Do they need dynamic changing of the schema? Do they need conformance to standards? Do they need highly expressive? And maybe their performance needs are low. They can do an overnight run, for example, so they don't need, microsecond response times. All this contributes to the choice of what language and what tools and what infrastructure are going to be the best option. Secondly, evaluating the languages and tools according to the criteria. So you need to know what the criteria are and then be able to evaluate those languages and tools that are out there according to the criteria and the customer's requirements. And then make a recommendation, taking the various trade-offs into account. So just to run through a quick list of some of the things that I pulled off this website by Mike Bergman, he lists a variety of comprehensive tools that kind of do a number of things in the overall process. So there's a tool from Antolvo, Semantic Network, something called Amin. There's an Apollon DTS distributed terminology system. There's a system called Dome, a programmable XML editor, which is being used in knowledge extraction to transform web pages into RDF. And all this is part of the bigger context in which ontologists are going to be building, ontologies and models. Moodle is another system by a company I think called Revolytics, community-oriented development of OWL. This is collaboration. Ontopia is more a topic maps-based tool. Protégé, everybody's heard of, top-grade composer. Again, these are very tools and widespread use, and ontologists are going to have to be not familiar with every single one, not to have working experience with every single one, but to be familiar with what's out there and to have working knowledge in enough to cover the range of capabilities, but also to be able to print them quickly, because they might go into a customer who's firmly, committed to Revolytics is Noodle. So guess what? You have to learn Noodle and you have to be part of that. So another skill is to be able to adapt to learn new different tools relatively quickly. Other kinds of tools, categories of tools, is tools that help in the initial development of the ontology. Maybe people like to work in concept maps, and then those can be translated into ontology. Ontology learning tools from text, that's another kind of tool. Some people have big corpuses and they don't know how to get started, and there's automated tools, that's another piece of the picture. And of course, importing from various formats, spreadsheets, databases, XML, feeds, anything you can think of, blogs. There's a lot of tools out there, a lot of companies providing tools. It's called this data up, spit it out as RDF, which we can build an ontology around, depending on the customer needs. And of course, there's a lot of tools that do ontology editing, but they don't do a lot more, so you export your ontology into a language feature. And there's a lot of ontology mapping tools. Ontology mapping is a phenomenally important thing, and it may be one of the major things that ontologists spend their time on. In particular, the Good Relations product offering ontology, it's starting to take off, and when it does, there's going to be a need for lots and lots of ontologies for product data. Previously, it didn't really need to be, but soon everybody's going to have ontologies, and then people who are going to build comparison shopping websites, they're going to need to map these ontologies. That could be a huge business in the coming years. And there's lots and lots of tools. There's academic competitions. I haven't tracked the details myself. And as I'm saying all this, I'm realizing that maybe no one person can know all this. So ontologists are going to have to specialize, just like doctors and lawyers and everybody else. Okay. And then there's ontology visualization tools and analysis tools. So once you have a big ontology and maybe some data that goes with it, you want to be able to see it very clearly, easily. And again, a lot of this will come with a given tool editing environment, and some are add-ons that you might use in the community. Another thing, importance of names. Some people think this is a kind of a trivial thing, and I don't think it's trivial. I think it's extremely important to follow and use good practice for naming. It's critically important for making the ontology, you know, easy to understand. And easy to understand is critical for maintenance, and maintenance is one of the biggest costs in any kind of software system, so it's actually quite important to be consistent in these good policies. A particular area, by the way, how many minutes do I have left? Hello? Yes, no. Anyway. Okay, so the URIs and versioning.
Sorry, I muted myself, so I didn't respond on the timing. You're all right, though.
How many, what, 2-3 more minutes left? What would you say?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So another problem, which is starting to rear its ugly head, is with the semantic web, there's two kind of contexts where you can do ontology. It's totally in-house. We don't really care about linking to the outside world. And that may be important for a long time. More and more people are realizing they need to link and use existing data sets and ontologies. And there's the problem with picking URIs and versioning, and I won't go into that in detail, but it's just something people are going to have to be aware of. What's happening, in fact, is we have to choose between, like if you have a new version of something, SCOS vocabulary was an example. They needed to evolve it in a certain way, and they had two bad choices. One choice was to create a bunch of new URIs for exactly the same thing, so now we have a lot of extra junk around. And the other option was to use the same URI but change the meaning. So now you've broken a contract of specific meaning that you said this is what it means, but it doesn't. So this is something we don't have a solution for, but it's something that ontologists need to be aware of. Another really critical thing is to be able to design ontologies and architect them in a good way so that they are nice modules that kind of fit together. So you need to know what modules are going to be there, how they relate to each other, instead of just having one big giant ball of goo. You need to know how to find and reuse existing ontologies rather than reinventing the wheel all the time. And also, to have a good judgment about knowing when to create a separate ontology module for a given thing that can be reused and it has enough kind of independence and genericness, versus realizing that, no, this is my particular problem here and I can't really see how a lot of other people are going to use this. That's another skill that one needs to develop to build good ontologies that are usable and easy to maintain and extendable. And along these lines is kind of the use. There's work that's been done in the last few years, spearheaded by Aldo Gangenia and Valentina Schutti, and the NEON Project, and they're developing and have published a catalog of ontology design patterns. So there's a website there, www.ontologydesignpatterns.org. There's a wiki. You can look up lots of different patterns, and this is something that ontology designers should be aware of. I mean, anyone who's out there who's built ontologies and scratched their head, well, how do I do this or how do I do that? A lot of people have thought about this before. You don't have to think of it from scratch. You just need to study the library of ontology design patterns, much like software designers study on software design patterns. And, of course, use them whenever possible. Create new ones, publish to the community, and then everybody benefits. Another area is standards. Very important to be familiar with the standards that are out there. To be able to talk to customers, understand to what extent it's a requirement for them, and then to know how and when to apply the standards, you know, in the larger context of a project that's going to be using ontology technology. Another thing, just kind of a simple thing, but it's worth mentioning just briefly, resources. Ontologists are going to need to know how to find, you know, the appropriate resources. They need to know which books are the best ones, and reading them, keeping up to date. Something that any professional has doesn't need to be aware of that. One more skill, I just looked in my notes, I kind of thought of it later. I think it's a really important skill, and I kind of, the first speaker made me think of it, you know, interviewing, social skills, talking to people. One of the things that often happens in ontology engineering exercises, especially if you're working with other individuals or customers, is people fight about terminology, okay? So you need to know how to deal with that. One simple way to deal with that is to say, okay, we don't need to worry about what to call this thing, but let's find out what you mean by it. So just people want their own definition for the word ontology or the word process or the word product. Well, that's fine, but let's just call it foo 1, foo 2, foo 3, foo 4. And everybody go around the room and say, this is what I mean by product, we'll call that foo 1. Great. We don't have to argue about what we mean by the word. And then you determine the common elements of meaning in all those things, and then after that you have a discussion and say, okay, this is what we can all agree on, and then later on you can decide what to call it. But people get so emotional about what to call things, and there's so much disagreement, misunderstanding when they use it. Anyway, so... that's that, and the last slide is about fun. You need to know how to have fun being an ontology professional, and what you need to do is go ahead and have that fun. And that's it.
Excellent. I can't agree more on that last point. and I think it's also tightly coupled with the ability to do knowledge of
reputation successfully. Can I just add one more thing I did forget to mention? My current status, I'm currently an independent consultant, looking around at different opportunities for what's going on. So if you need somebody with a lot of experience in ontology, give me a call or send me an email.
Okay, we can take maybe one question from Michael before we go on, otherwise we'll Anybody have an urgent question they want to get in now? I suppose I'm phrasing that so as to discourage. Let me take that back. Okay. Well, there are no hands up. So if it's all right with you, Michael, I think we'll keep going. And,
Hello?
Yes, Barry. Yes?
This is Ralph.
Ralph.
Can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, I just be unmute. Probably have to go to an airport where I'm going to soon, so I'm getting practice. I listen to this, but lots of interesting things Mike pointed out. I'm now focused on top quadrant. I've done ontology training, tools, etc., projects. And some of the projects I'm working in require ontology engineering to be about how to make these things work in the software engineering setting, and I want to make a very strong endorsement of what Mike said on design patterns. if people don't know what a design patent is, it's a template for expressing a reusable solution to a problem based on forces and outcomes and a solution intent and a description of the solution and known examples, etc. The kinds of patents that happen, of course, depend on the technology you're using, and that's another distinction to make when you speak of training on top of this. The other point I want to make is kind of following from the first talk from Denise, where I also endorsed the need to think about ontologies, not just classification. I'm in the NASA world doing enterprise architecture, data architecture. I'm actually formulating ontologies for the specification of telemetry packets in space. I'm using ontologies as specification models, where I generate things. I'm using that in manufacturing as a way to do model-based rules execution, and another kind of thing is happening with ontology. So the word ontology needs to be pinned down when you think about what it is we're up to. I thought there are ontologies that are the upper kind and the deep domain kind. Someone said once that there are ontologies of things, and ontologies about things, and ontologies for things. And this field is huge. And we need a way to figure out which part of the thing we're talking about. But I have more things to contribute, and I'm learning about how to do that on the wiki a bit more when I have my... I have to work in figures to get my busy schedule. But I need to think of how to make the contributions to the survey questions, and I ask for help there, because I'm not sure if I search around the wiki and find the survey and respond to it, what the protocol is for doing that. I'd love to touch a little bit. So I will request a call with Steve or Peter on or how to behave and contribute to the ubiquity coordinator. That's all I want to say now in case I don't get another chance. Yeah?
Okay. Thank you, Ralph. With that, let's go ahead in the interest of time and get our other panelists. Yes. Sorry, what was that? Oh. Okay. Let's get our other panelists' contributions in so that we have some time left after those as well. So, Mike Bennett, are you ready to go?
Yes. Sorry. Once you do fast win, you have to wait while it tells you to unmute it before you can actually be heard. It's slightly annoying. I've dialed in on a different phone, so hopefully my voice won't be coming and going or anything. So hopefully we can all hear each other. I haven't prepared any slides. What I'm going to do is just very briefly run through my experience and some possible lessons from that. Along the lines of the agenda points for today.
Mike, you are coming and going just a little bit. So I don't know if there's...
No, I'm on a normal cell phone. I tried dialing in on what I was told was a landline when I bought it, and it was just in Skype. So I actually just dialed in on my mobile, which should be as solid as anything. So.
Okay. As long as you continue to speak strongly, we'll probably be okay.
Thank you. Right. So, my name's Mike Bennett. For the last couple of years, I've been working on something in the financial services industry called the EBM Council Semantics Repository. And as of the beginning of this year, I'm now working full-time with the EBM Council. So you could say that I am a working ontologist. So I wasn't sure to talk about what I did know or what I didn't know, because it's still obviously a very new field. So I think the really key kinds of things that I want to keep at the back of our mind as I run through our experience. What does one need to know as an ontologist? What I would call prerequisites, what sort of things one ought to have a background in to begin with, the sort of understanding one ought to have. And thirdly, related to that, what sort of person one is. What sort of, are you an engineer or a technician? Are you a a geek or a business person? That kind of question as well, I think, is quite important. There's not always as much you can do about that, but I think that's quite important, and hopefully my experience will highlight that. So we start with what is ontology for? Well, I'll start with what our ontology is for. In the financial services industry, we've had various attempts over the last 10 years or so to create standardized messages using XML and then standardized data models and so on. And at the end of each exercise to produce a nice working standard, the business people have looked at it and said, well, this isn't really what we actually needed. What they really needed was standard terms and definitions to the actual things themselves. Because they really didn't know the word for it, what they needed was an ontology. So my brief with the EDM Council was to find a way in which we could connect the terms at a business level for financial security, processes, counterparties, you know, business entities and so on. Anything that you needed to have in your data models for security, so we're talking about, you know, bonds, equity, securities, derivatives and so on, but at a level of business understanding, because many of the technically perfect standards were actually quite incomplete because the business subject matter experts have not been able to understand what was being shown to them in a UML class model or an XML style printout or an XML schema, and so we never quite got to the point of identifying all the real things and real facts which were in the industry. And so clearly that was a requirement for using the semantic technology of creating an ontology at a business level. So that was what we were really trying to do. To put that in a context, although our initial requirement was simply to capture the terms and definitions, people are now saying to us, well, what can you do with this? And I think that comes back to the next point about what an ontology is for. Can we use it to better manage our data integration? Should we use it to create standardized messaging and so on? One thing we don't get so much of in our industry, but it's still a valuable thing, is the more conventional application of ontology to create a single, for example, our knowledge-based ontology where you have instance or individual terms as well as class terms. That has been less of a burning question in the financial services area. But either way, once you have an ontology, once you have a set of definitions of real things and facts about them, you're going to want to do something practical with it. And that brings me to what I think is the most important point. Whatever you're doing with it, unless it's something trivial, like a game or something, it's going to need to fit into some kind of formal development process and some kind of formal management framework as to how the organization derives business value from information held as data. Whether that's a conventional ontology type of application or whether it's better management of a model-driven approach to managing the content of their data resources and integrating those and getting the benefits of having a single set of terms and definitions which can be used to integrate a huge number of different systems and data sources. Typically in a financial firm, anything between 50 and 100 different systems with their own data models, different interfaces with different field formats and the supposed semantics in each of those terms. So the first thing is you really need to approach it as an engineer. And by engineer, I mean not somebody that understands and uses technology, but somebody who situates that use of technology within the business. That is the real definition between, say, somebody who's very good at electronics and somebody who's an electronic engineer, or somebody who's very good at chemistry and somebody who's a chemical engineer. An engineer is able to translate business requirements into technical solutions. And that means putting that within some kind of formal development process, whether that's the agile process or the walkable process or the lateral process or any of those. The first thing a good ontologist needs to be able to do is understand those different kinds of development process and how the use of ontology fits into that. And as part of that, and this is what was really the main focus of our work, is being able to present the ontology information, the terms and definitions, to the business and get business review and validation, and in the future then business origination of new terms, new complex financial derivatives, for example, starting at a business level and presenting those to the business people. That means, for example, they don't want to hear words like owl. You can just about get them to use the word ontology, that's fine. But if you start finding yourself in a world of acronyms, then you're probably the wrong person talking to those business people. You've got to come to their world and talk about their terms and definitions. But then at the back end of that, you need to be able to represent their world in a formal way, and that's clearly what ontology tools do. So I think the second very important thing which we recognized straight away was that you can't just take a tool and pull something into it and say, this is an ontology. In fact, to make that point, first thing I did was take the message standard called ISO 20022 and imported it into OWL. And what I got was a logical data model in OWL. And it's important that whoever is training up to be an ontologist must be able to distinguish between getting a tool to do something versus what the tool does, what is shown. In other words, we have to recognize the difference between the nature of the model and the language that model is in. Some of the very technical people will tend to confuse the form of the content and say, this is an owl, it's an ontology. And if I can take this to terms and XML logical design and pull it into owl, then I somehow have an ontology. And that's not the case. So as well as understanding business and engineering, the ontologist must understand and be able to conceptualize this concept to the sort of person. You've got to be not a technician, but an engineer, a person who's able to form and manage concepts and understand where those differ. And as part of that, be able to formulate and understand a theory of meaning and consistently apply a single theory of meaning to the work that they're doing so that they can sense the business case and without using baffling words like object property or anything, be able to say to the business, this is the set theory construct, for example, this is the kind of thing, this is the fact about that thing, and be able to explain that within a consistent theory of meaning that they're able to document on the fly. And finally, as we found, there were a lot of existing terms that we wanted to use from standards, and most of those are not semantic, so we had to look at how to reverse engineer or extract meaning out of those. The time goes by, we would expect more and more industry standards to be semantically based. And so you have to know the standards that are out there, you have to know the business area, and I'll tell you one thing I meant to mention. You need to know the business, but you also have to have a kind of active ignorance. You need to be able to ask the questions. So last week I learned something about the difference between over-the-counter thought instruments versus over-the-counter options, which was so obvious that I hadn't known it, and most of the data geeks hadn't known it, and the business people found it too obvious to say. So you have to know the business well enough to ask the few questions and get the obvious stuff written down, because if the ontology is not a way of capturing the business knowledge that isn't captured in technical models, then what exactly is it for? And so finally, and maybe the one area that I could learn more on and have learned some hard lessons on, is you've got to be a good analyst. You've got to be able to get the business knowledge out of the business people, capture it formally, present it back to them in a way that they can understand, but complies with a strong theory of meaning, and be able to get the best out of the business knowledge of the people in the industry, so that they know that you're making good use of their time, and that you know that what you're getting is a good representation of real knowledge, not technical design. And finally, then, the art of ontology is the art of not designing something. That's it. You okay with that?
Yeah, could you repeat that very last sentence you said again?
Sorry, just something you have to tell me to tell you. I've just given you an entire talk to fresh air.
It's a terrible unusual way.
The art of ontology is the art of not designing something.
Ah.
It's trying to capture what really is, not impress people with the design. If you do that formally and you do it right, then that gives somebody the basis on which to design from it. It gives you the basis on which to carry out control and change management of that design. The design is now driven from the business, because you have a business view that is not itself from some person's design.
That was really, that was extremely helpful, Mike. It occurred to me as you were going to try and capture some of what you were saying, your main point in that, and I of course didn't think of that until you were several points in, but
I also find it easier to talk not from slides, but I can try and capture that after the event and do it with some slides if you think that will help.
Yes, and I should say to everyone else that Mike accepted this panel passing on extraordinarily short notice and to ask for slides on top would have been preposterous anyway. So, it's absolutely fine. Just given the audio quality, I wanted to try and get the capture because I don't know if it's going to come through in the recording.
Absolutely, yeah. I'll do that. If I'd done the slides first, it would have taken time to go through them.
I understand.
I did it in the right order.
I understand. Okay. Steve has his hand up. Let's take a question for Steve, and then we'll go on to John.
Can you hear me okay?
Winston?
Okay, I have a question for Mike. You made that comment just at the end there about you feel that ontology should not be doing design, but only capturing the design using an ontology. And that led me directly to the issue that often, it seems to me, design is done in the process, or in fact, creating the ontology is the design process. And I just wondered if you were thinking those should be distinct activities, or how would you get around that?
I realize that is a possibly contentious statement, which is why I made it. But the point I'm making, creating ontology is very like designing something. But if you look at where it's situated within a technology management process, and people often put it in the waterfall when I say this, but even whether you're using Agile or Rational or any kind of process, unless you're literally just creating a game or something, if you have any application that has any business risk or loss attached to it, then you will be having some kind of formal process which separates out physical design, logical design, and the business conceptual view of things. If you look at the Rational framework, it's a good example of the first two columns of it. And this is broadly accepted practice for the last 100 years or so of engineering as a discipline. For what a program should do is quite straightforward. You have the physical code, you have the logical design, the pseudo code, and you have business requirements statements or use cases saying program shall do X, Y, Z. And this is how I explain this to the business folks. On the data side, you have the physical data design, you have the logical data model. What is the equivalent of business requirements for data? Well, the equivalent of business requirements for data is semantics. It is the business view, and there's, I think, about 7 rules for the business requirements specification should always follow, and I would apply those same rules to an ontology. It should be formally represented, it should be implementable, it should be understandable for business, in fact, reviewed and validated by business, and it should not contain any aspect of the design that's going to be carried out. So a good example would be in financial services, you have cash flow structures for interest payments on bonds, and you also have bonds called amortizing securities, in which the principal is paid off in a cash flow structure. Now, a good design, a good, wonderful design, will combine those structures, and that's a good thing. But if that logical design is now your only record of the thinking that was around the table when that design was made, then the knowledge of what are the real facts about interest payment versus principal payment is no longer there. And that may not be a problem in some cases, but if you look, for example, at the ISO 20022 standard, that was developed entirely at the logical design level. And when you look at it, it's impossible to know the knowledge that was around the table when that was created because it wasn't captured in some design-independent way. And so ontology, if you have a good theory of meaning around it and a good way of presenting it to the business, should be the way in which you formally capture that just right requirement at that design-neutral level and use that as a basis to drive design and, of course, to drive changes to design once you get beyond the third version. Does that make more sense to what I was saying?
I think so. I'm going to have to think about that a bit. I mean,
just briefly,
the follow-on would be how you capture the design as, the vehicle, if you like, in which you would capture a design and an ontology.
I don't know why you would capture design in ontology. I think ontology
is like an easy design thing. Can I make a very quick comment, 1 minute, on that
interaction?
Is that interesting in data?
Who is that?
I agree with what Mike has said about the separation of concerns to ensure survival longevity. What I wanted to add was the example from the Ministry of Justice in the Netherlands, where we are using rich ontologies as the legal domain to generate the XML schema specification for electronic messages. Now, the approach to that is to use transformations, is to figure out how you transform a rich ontology into the appropriate structures that are needed to make components to build business documents using UN CFAX CCTS as the organizing approach to structuring the XML side of things. The point I'm making here is that we can have our cake and eat it, if you like. We can have the rich world of design free specifications, and we can, with the appropriate transformations, and which are guided by annotations, of course, to know how to make those transformations. Same thing we're doing in NASA. I'll touch on this using XML Schema Plus as a specification language for XML, which is driven out of the ontology again.
I need to cut this off from going too far into detailed, though interesting, discussion because we still have.
I'm sensitive to that, and I like to be stopped. All right.
How convenient. Okay. Thank you very much. Right.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's move on to John Fella. John, are you there? Are you ready to go?
Here. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So, what I'll do is to talk...
You might want to speak up just a tiny bit if you can.
Okay. What I'm talking about now are the issues involved in taking specifications already expressed in some kind of language and mapping them into some kind of logic. And let me say that I agree with all of the issues that were described by the previous speakers and the commentators. I think all of these are very important. But one thing that I want to say is that it illustrates the point that the field of technology is in a very rapid state of development, and if you get down into the details of particular notations, you're in the area of things that are going to be obsolete very, very rapidly. But there are two things that really don't become obsolete, and those are the languages, the natural languages that everybody speaks, reads, writes, and speaks, and first-order logic, which has been around for 130 years without any change at all to its semantics. So on slide two of my talk, I summarized comments by three people who have been very sensitive to the issues of language and its mapping into some kind of a formal notation. One is Leibniz, who commented on the work that was being done in the 17th and 18th centuries about organizing terms and classes and concepts in genera and species, as he says. And as Leibniz said, those who have laid out all sorts of notions under certain headings or categories have done something very useful. And this was an extremely hot topic that Descartes, Pascal, Leibniz, and others were involved with in those 2 centuries. And it culminated in Immanuel Kant, who tried to get the foundation for putting all this together. Now, towards the end of the 19th century, my favorite philosopher, Charles Sanders Peirce, was developing his version of first-order logic. He also had been involved as an associate editor of the Century Dictionary. This was a very large, unabridged dictionary being developed in the United States as a sort of a competitor to the OED, which was being done in England. And first observed is the task of classifying all the words of language or what all the idiomatic expression is the most stupendous of logical tasks. Anybody but the most accomplished must break down in it utterly. And that, I think, is the critical thing, that this is by no means simple, going from language to logic. And pioneer in computer science, Esther Dijkstra, made the point that besides a mathematical inclination, an exceptionally good mastery of one's native tongue is the most vital asset of a competent programmer. And by that, he meant not just somebody who's writing the lines of code, but the person who looks at the problem, analyzes the problem description, and is sensitive to all of the logical and linguistic nuances and the philosophical and foundational and theoretical issues involved in mapping that into some sort of logical form. I'd also like to mention another person who's been involved with formal ontologies for a long time, and that's Doug Lennox, who started the Sykes Project back in 1984. And I was talking with him about some of the approaches. One point he made was that for every person that comes to Sykes looking for a job, they ask him to fill out this exam, to take a little exam, just translate a few sentences from English to first-order logic. And Doug mentioned that one of the candidates had a PhD in logic and had taught courses in logic. And Leonard apologized for giving him this exam, but he said that this is company policy, could you please do it? Well, this candidate happened to fail the exam, and he complained, that's not what we teach in our courses. And that, unfortunately, happens to be true, that the logicians back in the in the scholastic period in the Middle Ages were very sensitive about the problems of conceptual analysis and the philosophical and linguistic issues in analyzing a subject and mapping it into some sort of formalism. Now, their formalism wasn't as rich as our modern systems of logic, but the issues are very similar, and it's something that has been sadly neglected in many modern courses on logic. And here's a typical error that people have cited. Elephant is a species. Clyde is an elephant. Therefore, Clyde is a species. And people make mistakes like this constantly. This came from an artificial intelligence example years ago. But you find the same kinds of things being reproduced again and again and again. And somebody made the comment earlier that so many people think that all they have to do is to represent something in triples and put it in OWL, and it's automatically an ontology. And what you get is stakes like this, just absolutely horrible kinds of things. It makes it totally useless for any kind of reasoning. And one point that I make is that the little words mean a lot. The details of syntax, the details of the little words like the articles like A and B are critical. And the term, the sentence elephant is a species means that the word elephant is the name of a species. Clyde is an elephant means that some individual named Clyde happens to be a member of that species named elephant. And these 2 sentences, when you analyze them at that level, they do not imply that Clyde is a species. And this is the kind of error that you get constantly in these systems, and we see this all the time, even in some of these papers that are being submitted to journals for publication, and these are people who are supposedly trying to do research and think that they have a publishable paper, and they make trivial mistakes of this error, of this type. And this is the kind of thing that is very serious. One thing that I suggest that everybody who is doing knowledge engineering should have right on their desk is a dictionary, because the dictionary designed for people are not as formal and not as rich as the kinds of things that you need for ontology, but they're a lot better than nothing, and they certainly give you a list of all of the ways that people have been using these words, and it gives you a little reminder that if you're going to try to make these distinctions, look at the kind of distinctions that the lexicographers have noticed, and they happen to be professionals in the field. They are very sensitive to linguistic issues, and their comments, although they're not as formal and precise as you need for logic, they are often very, very relevant and a lot better than some person who just sits down and they just learned OWL and are trying to write down triples. I would suggest go look at the dictionaries and see what they've done there. Now, another point that I mentioned was Sykes' final exam. So in my slide number 7, I have a final exam which I would suggest that people who are logged in or anybody else who's interested might just try taking the following 6 sentences and translating them to first-order logic using your favorite notation. And these sentences involve a lot of very detailed kind of problems. The first 5 are just random sentences for typical things you might deal with, say, in English. Section 6 comes from an ISO specification reviewed by an ISO standards group for analyzing knowledge representations and translations to databases and knowledge bases. And all of these sentences raise a large number of different issues. And at the bottom it says that I intend to put on my website the answers to the representation for these 6 sentences. But I would like people to try playing with these sentences before they look at my website. If you look at my website now, you'll discover that it's not there. But I hope to have at least the first part of it available by tomorrow, and later on in the weekend, I'll have the full 6 sentences. But to look at slide number 8, just illustrate the notation that we are using at our company called VivoMind. It's called Common Logic Controlled English, or CELCE. And what we do is use this notation for relating phrases in English to phrases in another notation. In this case, I'm using CLIF. That's the Common Logic Interchange Format. But you can also use it to relate sentences in English to SQL queries, or you can represent it to conceptual graphs, or to other formal notations that are being used for knowledge representation. So sentence, each one of these represents a hint on how you might represent something in those 6 sentences on slide 7. So point number 1 says, define X finishes Y as left friend finishes XY. So on the right, we have a CLIF relation called finishes, which relates X and Y. And somebody will have to write axioms to specify what finishes means, but this is a definition that specifies how the syntax of English, or CELCE, the controlled English, in the or natural or full English, is related to this particular predicate in somebody's ontology. Now, number 2 illustrates a very delicate issue that comes up all the time, and that is, how do you represent verbs that have lots and lots of different relations? If you look back on slide number 7, the sentence is, on Fridays, Bob drives his Chevy to St. Louis. And how do you represent all these relationships? And a simple-minded way that you can, which is actually not bad for some purposes, is just to attach all these relations as arguments on your verb. And so you just say, if you've got a phrase of the form X drives Y to Z on some date or time T, just represented as a relation called drive with four arguments, X, Y, Z, T. Now, that will work, and in some cases that's fine, and actually it can be related to more detailed ontologies that go into a much finer grained analysis. And as a, if you just use the examples on at the level on slide number 7, you'll pass the exam, and at least you'll say, we'll say, okay, you at least understand first-order logic, and you at least understand basic issues of how to represent English sentences or information from English in those notations. But then we get to other things. Let's look at sentences 4 and 5 on on slide 7. If you watch a pot, it will not boil. And then sentence number 5 says, a watched pot never boils. And how do you relate the verb watches to the participle watched? And so on slide 8, I said, define X watches Y as left friend watches XY. Well, watches is a relation. Now, sentence 6 uses watched as a past participle in an adjectival sort of sense. And so in section 5, I define some watched Y is defined as there exists an X such that X is watching Y. And this allows you to relate some of these things, at least gives you a way of relating the verb watches and the participle watch to the same relation in your underlying ontology. And then we have, for section 6, we have X arrives at Y on T. And again, here this represents arrives X, Y, T. But again, this raises all these questions. Here we have two verbs that have a T on them. Like drives has a T as its last argument for time. But finishes, gives, and watches does not have T as an argument for time. And the question is, well, why are we doing it that way? And, well, the simple reason is that the sentence we're trying to represent didn't have a T. This is not a good generalizable approach, and you need a richer ontology to have a more systematic way of handling time. And so this gets to section slide number 9, and there at the top is a richer ontology, and the sentence is, Bob has an old Chevy, and on Fridays he drives it to St. Louis. Notice that I took the previous sentence, on Fridays, Bob drives his old Chevy to St. Louis, and I rephrased it in order to emphasize that Bob's possession of this old Chevy happens to be independent of Fridays. The way it was said before, one might ask the question, does Bob own a different Chevy every Friday? And when you say, on Fridays, Bob drives his old Chevy to St. Louis, is it the same Chevy every Friday, or does he have a different old Chevy on each Friday? And it's not clear. What I did in this case, in the English case, is to separate them out. And in the conceptual graph, I drew a box to separate the scope of the universal quantifier on Friday. So if you look at this conceptual graph there, outside the box, it says person Bob is linked by possessive relation, possesses a Chevy, and the Chevy has an attribute old. And then person Bob also, inside the box, happens to be the agent of driving. The point of the destination of driving is the city St. Louis, and the point of time on driving is every Friday. So every Friday, there's an instance of driving, and the destination is a city named St. Louis, and Bob is driving, and the theme of driving is the Chevy that Bob happened to have. And notice that in this case, drive happens to be represented as a concept node, and there's an implicit existential quantifier on that concept node. And for every Friday, there exists a different instance of driving. These are the kinds of issues that come up in our ontology. And the question is, how do you develop a systematic way of relating times and relating all these things, relating them to situations and to actions and events and various things? An enormous number of these issues comes up. And when you really want to have a very general ontology that can handle almost everything, you're going to have to deal with those kinds of things. And Then at the bottom, what I have is a translation of the conceptual graph into type predicate calculus. And there's also the conceptual graph interchange format and the common logic interchange format, which I didn't show here, but these are formats which I'll show on the slide on the more detailed specification that I post on my website. And if you want to know where that is, just go back to slide. Go back to slide number 7, and at the bottom it says that is where I there's a blue in blue, the HTTP in blue. If you click on that right now, you won't find anything. But by tomorrow or later in the weekend, I will have something up there that will go into more detail about these issues. And then go to the last slide, number 10. There's just some related readings. And this has a few pointers on something that you might want to look at to go into some of these issues in more detail. Okay, so that's basically the points that I had. If anyone has to have any questions or comments. Hello? Any questions or comments?
Thank you, John. Questions? Let's see any hands up yet on the chat room. Anybody? Up. Now I do. Robbie, go ahead, please.
Amanda,
yes.
With your permission, I just want to say kudos and thank you to all of you, at least my mentor, who has been guiding me so much through this effort. And I'm tired of answering even some offline or not so correct emails. Thank you, John. This also tells us a good thing to learn ontology in the light of logic. And subordinate logic, as well as how hard it is to express in natural languages and in ontology the simple concepts that we take them for granted in English anyway. Thank you. How soon machines are going to reach this maturity to understand semantically what we assume in our normal conversation?
Well,
I know at least it's a difficult question, but
That's a good question, and the answer is that depends on what you mean by the whole question of what you mean. There are certain things that they'll take a long, long time before we ever have everything understood. But if you look at those questions on the sentences on section 7, each of them is stated in a form that can be correctly analyzed by this parser we have that analyzes Selfie. That's the Common Logic Controlled English. And these are sentences that can be analyzed by Selfie, and they will be translated into a version of first-order logic that uses whatever ontology you give it. Now, the way that you specify that ontology to Selfie is according to the rules on section 8, where you, on slide 8, where you say define X finishes Y as left parent finishes XY. That will translate that phrase with whatever subject X and whatever predicate Y, whatever object Y occurs between the, on either side of the verb finishes. It will translate that to this kind of a, this predicate and click. You could also have on the right hand side a CGIF for conceptual graph representation. You could have SQL and other formalisms. But one thing that I want to emphasize is that asking people to write clear statements in English is not at all easy. And if you look at the questions on the statements on slide 7, these all have been carefully written by somebody who knows ahead of time what is going to come out in first-order logic at the end. And so they're written in such a way that everything will work and that it will be translated correctly by the system. On the other hand, if you have somebody who does not know first-order logic, it is extremely difficult for them to write clear sentences like this. And one of the points that I keep making is that up until the end of the 19th century, people used to study Aristotle's logic, and every university student was required to take a course in logic where they did conceptual analysis and they studied grammar and logic and rhetoric. Those are the first three subjects in the, those are the first three of the seven liberal arts called the trivium, grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And they learned how to analyze sentences. Now, they translated them into syllogisms, which, by the way, happened to be a subset of description logics like OWL. And the point I make is that a student from the 19th century who had taken a good university course would be better qualified to write OWL today than most of the students that come out of the universities today. And the simple reason is that students of the 19th century learned logic. It wasn't full first-order logic, but it was a useful subset, and they also learned how to analyze sentences in English or other languages and map them into Aristotelian syllogisms, which are a subset of the description logic. And that is something that really is a disaster for the 20th century, and I blame Bertrand Russell about that, because Bertrand Russell used to think that Aristotle was a competitor, and so he was trying to get the universities to stop teaching Aristotle. And he was successful in doing that. They stopped teaching Aristotle, Aristotelian logic, to every incoming freshman, but the net result is that they never taught them anything else, and so nobody learned anything.
I want to raise my hand. As co-chair, maybe, Amanda, you'll permit me to say that I think the point that John has made with respect to the topic we're on of what does the ontologist have to know is well made now, and we have to move on in the interest of time. I was trying to say to the end of this, and I think systems of logic are very important. The need to deal not just with first order, but higher order logic, modal logic, deontic logic, the whole rambit of logic is an important thing that ontologists have to know. For sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, let's do move on. We have a few of questions now.
Thank you, John. Thank you so much.
Yeah, there's an anonymous, which may be the one that morphed into Michael Eschol, and then there's Michael Eschol. Is there, is that first anonymous is somebody other than Michael? It's Michael? Yeah. Michael, you're on.
Yes, thank you. Hi, John. Interesting, all your nice examples about logic. I'm just wondering, from your experience, you're in business, you're not doing customer work, as far as I understand. From my perspective, I don't see that there's much use in having people translating the sentences into first-order logic. For ontologists today, they don't even want to bother with OWL. So I'm just interested in your experience. Why in practice do you think that commercial ontologists are going to be needing to translate English into first-order logic?
Okay. I am saying that this is just an example that Doug Lennox found very important, and he used this as his approach. And I would say that it's not going to be necessary to translate first-order logic into first-order logic for every system. On the other hand, if you learn how to map English sentences into first-order logic, it's with anything. If you learn OWL, you have learned very, very little. In fact, people who learn OWL, most of them just know how to put angle brackets, and they know practically nothing about ontology. But if you learn how to translate an English sentence into first-order logic, you can map it into Hornclaw's logic for doing logic programming. You can map it into syllogistic logic for syllogism. You can map it into OWL. You can do anything. And if you know how to do that, you will never be obsolete. But if all you know is one little tool, you will become obsolete as soon as somebody moves to the next tool.
That's a good argument. Thank you.
Okay, Mike Bennett. Don't forget to unmute yourself. Eric Reed. Mike Bennett, you there?
That's star three. Unmute.
Fine, sorry about that. For some reason, it didn't work the first two times. Two questions for John. That's really great to see, talking about the understanding of logic and the principles of things. I just wondered whether one could extend that to some of the other things that you've written about in the past, and in particular, the ability to partition an ontology and, divide the upper ontology into different partitions for your rapid theories, or to be able to understand and apply ALAP is superior to an ontology. I think that's a kind of universal skill that one should expect ontologists to know as well.
I would hope that we have tools that will assist the ontologists to use this. And one of the things that we're doing in our company is to design tools so that we can reduce the amount of learning that people have to do, that a subject matter expert has to learn in order to do useful things. And one of the reasons why I was emphasizing this use of Selfie is that we had some success stories where we had a couple of geologists who had never really studied much of logic at all, and they were able to do a great deal of work in building up the ontology or supplementing the ontology we already had with information about rocks and land formations and hydrocarbons and various other kinds of things that are dealt with in the oil and gas exploration field, and in order to tailor our plain vanilla ontology in order to deal with that specialization. And I think that is the goal that we're trying to do with our company, and I think that a lot of other people are trying to do, is to develop tools and methodologies so that we can take people who never had a decent course in logic or a decent course in grammar in the trivia of the trivium of grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and begin to do useful kinds of work so that they can help our computer, collaborate with the computer system into building up the underlying ontology that is necessary.
Right.
Okay, we have a question from Jim Disbrow, or Disbrow, I'm sorry.
Disbrow,
I'm not sure.
Disbrow. Yeah.
Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, John, I would point out that, you know, the phrase that Bob has an old Chevy and on Fridays he drives it to St. Louis, and also in the previous one where on Friday Bob drives the Chevy to St. Louis, that this sentence is actually reflexive, and that I don't see that the first-order logic that you have written expresses this reflexivity correctly, because, you know, when he drives himself in a vehicle, and so the reflexive nature is not being reflected. And is there some easy way to handle that?
Okay, that is not that is an issue that has nothing to do with first-order logic. First-order logic would certainly represent that. That is an issue having to do with the definition of the verb drive. And there's two kinds of interpretations. One is that there are multiple meanings involved with drive. Sometimes they're classified as different word senses, or others can be that you have a large number of different participants in it, so that associated with driving is the fact that the person who is the agent of doing the driving versus the person who is being driven. And in this case, in these issues, there's a linguistic relation such as agent. The agent of driving is one who is actively doing it. The theme is something that is being driven. And then you could also have the beneficiary, the person who is being driven, driven for. So, for example, if you have the...
I don't think that we could argue for eons about the interpretation.
I just want to summarize it very quickly. That's an issue of ontology, and that would be involved with the definition of drive, and if you really get into the details, you do have to do that, and it's not an issue of logic, it's an issue of ontology.
Okay, thank you. John, we're almost out, or well, we're about out of time. I'm going to, I think, exercise chair's privilege to make a final comment / question. Since I'm the only hand up right now. I did wait in the queue, anyway. As you may or may not recall, I'm a former cyclist, and my transition from philosophy graduate studies to the world of applied ontology came via psych and the tests that you refer to. And I want to say two things, and one of them will actually bring us back to something from the earlier speakers. One is that indeed, of all the places I've worked, or a much bigger set, the places, the organizations with whom I've worked, who have some higher ontologists, the test of having somebody think out loud about how to model something is the only successful one I've seen at predicting who's going to be a good ontologist once they're trained. nothing else. No academic. Yeah.
Excellent point.
The other thing I wanted to say, though, is actually a slight disagreement, but it brings back to some earlier talks, and I'd like to get your response to it, perhaps because I'm not a linguist, I tend to find the emphasis on the English sentence or the language a little bit off, but it's probably because in my experience, what you actually have to do is not translate, as an ontologist, is not translate sentences, but translate something like assertions or information people need, right? And the articulation varies somewhat, and for most applications, you do also need the linguistic mapping for the term, but you have to be able to represent that Bob has a car, however it's phrased, and then the actual typical five-part test actually is just this sort of thing that you and Jim just did, where the interviewee responds with a model, and the interviewer says, "Oh, but that could mean this," and makes you make a wrong decision. Now, how would you redo that so that I don't have that problem?
I couldn't agree with you more. I totally agree Excellent. With you that the whole issue of modeling and analysis and purpose and intention and all of the whole pattern of not only of looking at how it's going to be used in the entire picture, all of that is essential. I am just focusing on what I can present in 10 minutes, and one of the issues in 10 minutes is that all of those issues were you were talking about could be stated in English, and what I'm talking about is taking the entire set of everything that you want to deal with and mapping that into your formal system, and 10 minutes was all I could do with it.
Absolutely. Wonderful, John, and thank you very much. We are a little bit over time, so I think we are going to have to close the discussion, but obviously there's a lot more to be said. I would highly encourage, as we mentioned, actually two forms of asynchronous contribution. One is responding to the surveys, and you won't find everything that has been mentioned today and that or that you may feel strongly about and hasn't been mentioned today may not be specifically listed as an option in a relevant question, but there are spaces to write those in on just about every question. So please do that. And also, I ask you to remember that the Ontology Summit has community input pages for every track. We haven't been terribly active with that in this track, but one very good use of that to continue this sort of listening clarification of skills and points and areas of ability. And also if people are so inclined and would like to put up their own version of what the panel today of answering making their top points for these criteria. That's also something to put on that community input page. I put the link in the chat, but it's also on the Ontology Summit page as well. Thank you, everyone. Thank you to our panelists. All presentations have been wonderful. And I really we all appreciate your making this contribution to our professional self-understanding today. Peter, anything I've forgotten to wrap up with that?
No.
Okay. The session is hereby closed. Thank you, and see you all online.
Thank you.